In some ways, climate change is a symptom of an energy problem. And the energy problem is that we derive most of our energy from fossil fuel sources, which have allowed us to build this society that we see today, which is a very energy-intensive society, but also has all of the modern technology that allows us to live quite comfortable lives. We realise there's a cost to that now, and that cost is the fact that generating energy from coal creates a lot of carbon dioxide, and also from oil and gas. Oil and gas are running out, and coal isn't an infinite source. Eventually, we're going to have to change to different energy sources. So in that sense, climate change is simply something that's accelerating the process of energy change that's going to have to happen anyway. I don't think very many people at all would dispute the fact that we're going to run out of fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are polluting in other senses. Coal produces a lot of mercury, a lot of soot and ash. And what might surprise a lot of people, it produces a lot of radioisotopes such as uranium and thorium. And so we'd rather get rid of coal and avoid the acid rain, avoid the soot, avoid the mercury pollution of our rivers and lakes, and avoid the radioisotopes that are produced, and switch to other energy sources. So I can only consider that people who argue that CO2 isn't driving climate, and therefore we shouldn't switch off fossil fuels, are arguing for a delay in that change, because the change ultimately is inevitable.
Mm. Yeah. The other thing I notice in Professor Plimer's comments is his description of climate change advocates as being religious fundamentalists of a sort. Do you think this sort of language is appropriate or helpful? It seems to be somewhat intemperate to me and seems to have an agenda of its own. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think Ian Plimer's setting up a straw man position throughout his book, where he claims that large parts of the scientific community are ignored when looking at the issue of climate change. For instance, his own area of geology, he says, is overlooked by the climate science community. It's all focused on the atmosphere and what greenhouse gases does to the air, which of course is patent nonsense. If you actually take the time to go and look at the report, for instance, produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change last year, which was a comprehensive review of the scientific literature, there's chapters on the Earth, on the past effects of climate change, so what we call paleoclimate, effects on the ocean, and effects on the biology of the Earth system as well. All of these contribute important evidence to understanding climate change. And so Ian Plimer's pretending that they are not being considered, and therefore built his case around the fact that he, as a master of geology, therefore has much credence to lend to it. If you go and look at the reports of the IPCC, there are plenty of geologists on there who have contributed important knowledge to understanding the effect of climate change in the past and the effect of it in the present. So I would argue that Ian Plimer, in fact, has an ideological position that he's arguing from that's not at all reflective of what actually goes on in the real scientific community, with which he should be engaging rather than fighting.
Mm. So Professor Plimer talks of a large number of very qualified scientists who have reservations about the causes of climate change. Would you have any rough estimates of what sort of percentage of scientists would deny the idea of climate change being caused by human activity? I mean, is it a large amount or is it a tiny little sliver? Or
There's two parts to that question. One is a very small amount of people would deny that human activity has any role in climate change. Some slightly larger fraction would argue that natural effects override the human impact on climate change. In other words, that the sensitivity of the climate system to carbon dioxide is low, and so other effects such as the sun and volcanoes have a predominant effect. The vast majority of people who work in this area are strongly of the view that the climate system is relatively sensitive to carbon dioxide, and so a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is what is likely to happen under a business-as-usual scenario within the next 3 decades, will cause a warming of the Earth of 3 to 6 degrees. Most of those people who are credible in the scientific community but are arguing for a lesser effect are saying maybe the effect will be 1 degree Celsius change.
Okay. In your review of the book, you say that Professor Plimer seems to rely very highly on the idea of Popperian falsifiability. Can you tell us about Karl Popper's idea of falsification and how it should be applied in this debate?
So one way science can operate is to set up a hypothesis and then set up a critical experiment that can disprove the hypothesis. So if you say, for instance, that all swans are white, and you go out and observe 100 swans and they're all white, as soon as you observe a black swan, then the hypothesis that all swans are white is falsified.
Right.
Now, what Ian Plimer's claiming here is you can do the same thing with the climate system. You can have multiple lines of evidence to show that carbon dioxide is causing climate change, but as soon as you find one piece of contradictory evidence, then all of those other lines of evidence are thrown out.
Right.
So he's using the swan argument in something as complex as dealing with climate change, when in fact what it suggests are that there are multiple processes operating, and in some circumstances they can become more or less important. Now, anyone who understands biology or even Earth systems analysis understands that it's not a matter of falsification, that classic reductionist view, which can work well in basic physics and chemistry and works quite poorly in fields such as ecology or Earth system science or behaviour, for instance, behavioural psychology. These are areas of science that are not amenable to that sort of treatment. And so he's trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, and of course it doesn't work. And so he's come to this weird conclusion that if he can find lines of evidence that are contradictory to what he imagines should be the case, the whole edifice of climate science comes collapsing down, when in fact all he's done is chipped a little bit off the wall.
Right, yeah. He talks about the climate scientists have got an over-reliance on computer models and not much about observations in the real world. What's your response to that?
It's another one of those strange straw man positions.
Right.
If you ask most climate scientists what they considered the strongest evidence for climate change, they would say the strongest evidence is from paleoclimate and the effect of CO2 and other drivers of climate on past climates. The second strong line of evidence is what we call observational evidence. So what we've seen happen to the climate system over the last 100 years and how that has evolved along with the theory of climate science that comes from physics and chemistry and biology. So predictions were made, for instance, back in the 1930s that CO2, being a greenhouse gas, would start to change the climate as it accumulated in the atmosphere, long before there were really any changes observed or any attempt to get a global record of temperatures, and that has since been borne out. There was a strong argument back in the 1970s as to the human effect on the climate system, and in that case, there was an argument about how much CO2 would warm the climate and how much pollutants, low-level pollutants, that hang around as haze over cities and farmland, such as sulfates, aerosols, dust and so on, would cool the climate because there's these countervailing effects. And so the argument there was, would it be a net cooling or warming effect depending on how much CO2 versus pollutants there were? The consensus view back then was that the warming effect would predominate, and there was a famous report commissioned by the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, commissioned by the president, in order to report back on this in 1978. This is the famous Charney report. Anyone can download it from the web and read it. It's only 22 pages long. So this was a report produced 31 years ago that strongly suggested that increase in CO2 emissions would lead to a strong warming pattern, which may be difficult to detect in the next few decades. This is speaking from a position of 1978, but would become increasingly apparent after that, just as we've observed. And so it's not about looking at what's happened over the last 30 years and trying to fit some ideas to it. In fact, much of this science was developed well before we had any of that observational evidence, and then that's been verified. What climate models do are allow us to integrate lots of lines of evidence, something that would be vastly too complicated for any one human brain to wrap their idea around. So to integrate these are often called an integrated risk assessment or an integrated model, and then use that as a basis for coming up with essentially storylines about the future, because the future is always uncertain, and one of the greatest uncertainties is how much extra carbon dioxide we'll produce in the future. Do we continue on burning coal and oil and gas at the rate we're doing, or are we switching to low carbon energy sources? That's one of the uncertainties. Another one is how sensitive the climate system turns out to be to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And so when projections are made about future change, all of these uncertainties are accounted for, and these models provide a tool to evaluate that as a risk assessment. So you have low-range projections of, say, 2 degrees warming, and you have high-range projections of 6.5 degrees of warming. Mm. And within that envelope, the reality is likely to lie. So climate models are a tool in integrating the two primary sources of evidence, which are past evidence of past climate change and observational evidence of climate change over the last 100 years, and then they're a way of wrapping all this together and making some predictions of possible scenarios for the future without trying to be definitive and without trying to make a precise prediction.
Right. I also find interesting in your review something that might not be apparent in the H&E, the book, that is that most of the authorities that are quoted as having doubts about one particular piece of evidence for human-induced climate change are still in general persuaded by the majority of evidence that human-induced climate change is in fact real. Can you comment on this? Is this a case of just misquoting people when you saying it makes it look like there's a lot more sceptics than there actually are, when they might be sceptical of one little area, but of the whole thing, they still are basically believers?
Yes, well, I wouldn't say believers, because believers are people who would have faith in something irrespective of evidence. And these are people who look at the evidence and assess the body of evidence, the whole body of evidence, which Ian Plimer ironically claims to do and claims to reject this idea, when in fact this is what all scientists do, look at the body of evidence. So, for instance, Ian has over 2,100 references, footnotes in his book. But if you look carefully through the footnotes, you find that a large fraction of them are scientists who have authored parts of the IPCC report, who have strongly argued in other ways that humans are having an impact on the climate. Indeed, I'm one of the people cited in his book. and so he's arguing a particular position, citing the scientific literature to do this, with the implicit implication that therefore these people must agree with what he's saying. But in fact, to argue different aspects of the whole body of evidence and then by implication suggest that all of these people must therefore draw the same conclusion as him is one of those misleading lines of argument that Ian Plimer has used. So there's a lot of people who disagree with particular components of the climate change story. Mm. Very few of them who would say that the overall net effect means that humans are not having an effect on the climate.
Yeah. So Professor Plimer seems to be saying that climate scientists have fallen prey to some sort of religious ideology and have gotten sloppy in their science. He mentions three things that scientists can do to get things wrong. He mentions trimming, cooking and fraud. Can you quickly explain what these terms mean and tell us why you think that in general these errors have not been made by the whole scientific community?
Well, trimming is the idea that you have a nice, neat data set that fits your preconceived hypothesis quite well, but there's one or two data points that don't, and so you leave them out in your analysis and say, well, look how well it all fits. Mm. So trimming those two data points that may not fit your theory, but in fact could be critical for understanding why it's flawed or inadequate, is obviously not good science. Another one is misrepresenting the evidence. So putting it in a context for which it's not appropriate. And the third one, which no scientist should ever do, is misrepresenting data or presenting fraudulent data. And I'm afraid to say Ian has used many figures in his book that don't represent science data at all. There's no citation for them, and they don't represent reality. Mm. One classic example, indeed, is the third figure in his book in the introduction, which shows a plot of global temperature change over the 20th century. Now, this is an identical plot to that which appeared in the first edition of a so-called documentary show called The Great Global Warming Swindle, which was, in that first edition, attributed to NASA, so one of the organisations that actually collects data, but in fact was later shown that it wasn't anything like the NASA plot. And one of the tricks that had been used in that plot was to delete the last 2 decades of climate change and then shift the axis along. So to pretend that where we were in 1980 was in fact where we were in the year 2000, to then argue that most of the warming had occurred prior to 1940. Mm. Now, Ian knew that was the case. I mean, in fact, in a later version of that documentary, the one aired in Australia, a different temperature series out of the Arctic was substituted because it was pointed out that that was in fact a fraudulent representation of the data. So one wonders why, if Ian is so convinced of his case, he would have to use data like that in his book in preference to the real information in order to make his argument. Those sort of factors in his book really undermine the whole credibility of it.
Have you challenged him with that? And what's been his response?
I've talked to him about that, and his response is not to have a response, is to obfuscate or just to skirt around the issue. Right. Some of the listeners may have heard his interview on Lateline, ABC Lateline, a few days ago, and there were a couple of pointed questions put to Ian then that, in my view at least, in listening to it, he didn't answer at all. He just skirted around, and it seems this is the case again. And so he accuses scientists of having positions that, when challenged with inconvenient data, they ignore, when in fact Ian's doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Well, what sort of what does the scientific community do when that sort of thing starts to happen, when they think someone's actually come? I mean, what can you do to someone? You can't put them in jail for scientific fraud, can you? Not that, you know, I'm talking about in any case, not just Professor Plimus, but it's not illegal to do, is it?
No, that is a matter of public justice as to whether decisions are made or not on the basis of evidence that's not correct. Mm. Ian hasn't published this in a peer-reviewed journal, for instance, and so there's been no one to say, well, this is wrong, you can't publish it, and no editorial decision made on that basis. Obviously, the book publishers either didn't check that figure or are unconcerned about whether the data is real or not. But, of course, this is a topic which impinges hugely upon public debate, and so a lot of people of the audience are going to read this book and examine the figures and have no idea which figures are correct and which figures are not, and therefore draw conclusions on that basis. And I think that's part of the intention, that because 99% of the people who read that book won't have an idea about what the real data is, they'll believe what's read in there.
Yeah, and that leads me to this next question. Is it's not a book aimed at scientists, is it? It's I think the term he used, it's aimed at the average punter. How appropriate is that, in your opinion, to write books like this that are very technical and they're very controversial, and yet they're aiming, like, is there a book aimed at the average punter that's giving the other view?
There is. There are books like that, but they tend to be at two levels. One of them is at the level of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, for instance, which conveys a lot of the evidence, but not really the science behind it, because it's not meant to be at all technical. Yeah. And then you can move to a book, for instance, called Climate Change Adaptation Mitigation Solutions. It's by an author who was a former CSIRO scientist, and it's just been published this year, a few months ago. But that's really stepped up to some level of technicality that most people may not be interested in.
Mm.
So it's hard to convey a complex subject to a lay audience and retain the scientific rigour in it.
Yeah.
You can certainly present it in a way where a lot of the evidence of impacts, for instance, are conveyed, but you're always going to leave gaps in explanations in that way. Now, there's nothing stopping someone publishing a book like Ian has. It's a free world. You can publish fiction novels, and that's essentially what this is, a fiction novel, and there's no law against doing that. What I find peculiar is the amount of coverage this book has got in the mainstream media in terms of presenting as though it is not a fiction book, as though it is real science, and as though all of the information contained within it, it reflects reality and reflects what actually has operated in the scientific community, which it doesn't.
Mm.
So I think that's the danger with the book, that it's perceived to be reality when it is in fact mostly fiction.
Right.
And so it's misrepresented. And some newspapers, for instance, the Australian newspaper, I think is particularly guilty of this in presenting a very one-sided opinion of this whole area, essentially casting it as some debate between one group of scientists or another. And the way it's been presented is so unbalanced that it seems as though the vast majority of scientists would agree with Ian Plimer's view, and of course that's rubbish.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to hand you over to John Rice from Clean. He's just got a couple of questions he just wanted to ask. John?
Yeah, thanks, Craig. I'd just like to pick up on that issue of the Weekend Australian, because 2 weeks ago, as you say, they welcomed Plimer's book, with no less than three positive articles, including an editorial that was very favourable. And I noticed that Robert Mann wrote in the next week, and they did publish his comments, the Professor of Politics at La Trobe, and he accused them of cheerleading for zealotry and engaging in a grave intellectual, political and moral mistake. This paper has a long history of supporting climate denialism. Christopher Pearson from Adelaide is one of their regular columnists, and as you'd know, he's often denying climate change. I'm just wondering what... It's not really a science question, but I'm just wondering your personal thoughts on why do you think the Australian has such a strong orientation in this direction? It's been going for some time. And in comparison, how do you see the record of other media in this respect? And as a scientist, what policies would you like to see the Australian media adopt in reporting on this really critical issue?
Well, it's difficult to speculate on the motivations of any particular editor or newspaper policy. But you can note that the Australian newspaper spends very little time debating the mainstream science in almost any other area except climate change. So there's something peculiar about climate change as opposed to evolution by natural selection or biochemistry or the physics of Jupiter's moons. You know, it's not discussing any of these essentially ever. They may appear in a science article in a higher education supplement. And yet here it hammers on almost daily about the science of climate change, holding very strong views about it, and making not hiding the fact that there's a strong connection between the science of climate change and its implications for public policy and for economic decision making. So I think the answer is that this is an area of science that does have strong immediate implications for policy in terms of what we do about energy supply and how we would change energy supply, for instance, putting a price on carbon and the mechanism by which we might do that. And my presumption, and it's only a presumption, is that the Australian newspaper's editorial policy is one that wishes to influence the policy on carbon abatement or not.
And a book like this, one of the problems of such books, and especially if they get popular, which this one seems to be doing, is that the poorly conducted science that you've mentioned can... Sometimes these arguments can become memes, little simple slogans or pseudo-facts that are easily repeated uncritically by the wider population. What are the arguments in Plimer's book that you think would be likely to be picked up and repeated in this way and become these kind of memes? And what would you say in advance to kind of inoculate us all against these?
I guess two of the themes he's picked up on are that climate has changed in the past and it's been very variable. And by implication, therefore, climate will change again in the future and will be very variable, and we've just got to live with it. Now, that can be a powerful meme, as you say, this idea that carries on of its own volition and eventually comes back to the person who repeats it in the first place, and since they've heard it from an alternative source, it must be true. These are the sort of ideas that spread of their own power. And so that idea that climate's changed in the past, so therefore we can never affect it, even from a purely logical point of view, is rather silly. I mean, if you found a dead person lying on the road with a gunshot wound, you might conclude that they died from cancer, because many people in the past have died from cancer. And so sure, they had a gunshot wound, but they may have died of cancer before they got shot. And this is much the same sort of problem you have here, that yes, climate has changed in the past for many different mechanisms, and in fact these provide us with a tool to understand the effect we may be having on the climate system now and the effect we may have in the future. And a second important point here is that people weren't around for most of these climate changes in the past, especially the particularly dramatic ones, and even more importantly, a modern energy intensive industrial society supporting 6 billion people was not around when these changes had occurred in the past. So even if these changes have occurred in the past, it doesn't make it less of an adaptation challenge now. But just arguing that the climate can change for all manner of reasons and therefore we shouldn't worry about it is likely to be a view that Ian is trying to push forward in his book and will be one of those memes that emerges.
Just back to you, John. You've got a few more questions there.
Yeah, CLEAN, the local climate group, is part of a broader climate movement globally, which has often made the point that in many ways the climate denialists are often a creation of the fossil fuel industry. And it's part of a tactic to at least just create some doubt that global warming exists and to create the impression that there is real there's no real scientific agreement. They make the point that this is reminiscent of the tactics used by the tobacco industry in the last half of the 20th century, where millions were spent on just fueling doubt that cigarettes caused cancer or that tobacco was addictive. So if that's true, if that's the tactic that's out there on behalf of the fossil fuel industry, what do you think of the argument that the scientific community should actually ignore these sort of denialist texts, because it just gives publicity to their publication, the debate itself, and helps to give the book and its promotion oxygen due to the ensuing public debate?
If you look at how vast the scientific community is who works on this issue or issues related to climate change, even if they don't consider themselves climate scientists themselves, the vast majority of people do in fact ignore it and don't engage with the public. You only see a few scientists who are actually willing to go out there and talk in the public arena about it. And all of that huge silent majority, busily beavering away in their ivory towers, are never heard. And so I think this is part of the distortion that's then able to become apparent in the media, is that it's perceived as a very balanced debate, and you have certain individuals who get a lot of airplay, and they may be quite good public speakers. They may be able to get out there and argue a case, essentially like a high school debate, and do very well in it. There's an old saying that a rogue will drag you down to their level of argument and then beat you by experience, and that's very much what happens in this case. That many climate scientists who try to engage in a public debate are not particularly good at debating, because they do it in quite a technical way, which are married to evidence rather than to debating points like a lawyer might try to do it in court, and so they're not willing to engage in that sort of debate. So it, and of course, the classic media position in so many areas has been to have two sides of the story, and it's hard to see how that will ever go away. Now, if you wanted to have a balanced debate in the media, then you'd have 99 climate scientists presenting their viewpoint, and then you'd have a climate change pseudo-skeptic like Ian Plimer coming on and presenting his. Instead, over the last 2 weeks, we've had Ian Plimer and Ian Plimer and Ian Plimer and then a few others and then Ian Plimer again, and maybe one or two people like me sort of popping up there. So not only does it not properly present the debate as in reality, it in fact appears as though there's me and a few other people like David Caroli and all these other people who are arguing against him. So it provides a laughably distorted view of what the reality is, which of course suits those who wish to delay. Now, at the start of the program, I raised that issue about delay. In this case, there are many reasons that we have to get off fossil fuels at some point in time, probably within the next century anyway. So these delaying tactics and producing doubt are simply buying a decade or two more time in order to continue on as business as usual.
And on that question of timeline, I've heard you talk before about how you think time is critical. What would you say about that sort of delay? If we do delay for two or three decades, what's your prognosis?
I guess it's a bit like someone who smokes. You brought up the tobacco lobby idea a moment ago. The longer you smoke cigarettes, the higher the chance you'll get of developing emphysema or lung cancer or cancer of the throat and so on. If you smoked for 2 years in your teens, you're very unlikely to get that. If you continue to smoke throughout your life, you're very likely to die from a smoking-related disorder. The longer we continue to allow the build-up of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the more committed we are ultimately to damaging climate change, and the less of these effects will ultimately be reversible and adaptable. So 1 year doesn't make or break our adaptation and mitigation of climate change. But each year in which not only do we not do anything, but we allow carbon emissions to continue to grow, which is what's happened every single year over the past decade, then the problem becomes more and more unmanageable. Now, there is a risk at some point that we cross what are known as tipping points, where the system that is responding to human activity responds back and starts to take control of its own destiny. And a good example of that is, should we trigger large-scale melting of ice in the Arctic and the permafrost, which is the area around Siberia, northern Canada, that holds vast stores of carbon in the form of ancient plants and peat moss and vegetation that's been locked up in a frozen state for many thousands of years. If we melt that, and then that rots and releases these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, it's a very hard job to put them back again. And so at that point, there is a danger that we will have heated the Arctic to the point where it's releasing more carbon into the atmosphere each year than all of human industrial activity. So then we could stop all of our activity, we could decarbonize our economy completely, and it would be too late. It's a bit like right now we're riding a bicycle along a road and we're pedaling to keep it going. Now, if we took our feet off the pedals and didn't apply the brakes, the bicycle would gradually grind to a halt. But if we go over a crest of a hill and we take our foot off the pedals, and even if we try and put the brakes on at that point, it's very difficult to stop ourselves because the hill could end up being quite steep. That's the risk we run in delaying.
And one last question. You mentioned the point about there are many reasons why we need to cut back on our CO2. And I'm wondering, even if what Plimer says is true, let's imagine that the CO2 is not shifting the climate in any significant way, should we be concerned about CO2 emissions for other reasons? For example, could you outline what is sometimes called the other CO2 problem, the growing acidification of the oceans? What's happening here, and how big a threat does it pose? And is it reason in itself enough for us to do something about curtailing our carbon emissions?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there are some beneficial effects of higher CO2. It increases the ability of plants to draw carbon out of the atmosphere and grow. And so the productivity of most plant species will increase. Some will be preferred over others, but overall you'll get a net growth of plants, and that's often been used by people to argue that CO2 is beneficial. But, of course, once you offset that with the impact of warming and changes in the amount of rainfall, then that beneficial effect pretty quickly is dispersed. But then the direct effects of CO2, and one of the most important of those is where the extra fossil carbon is going into the oceans, can have a very damaging impact irrespective of whether the planet's warming. And it's often called ocean acidification. More technically, it's a reduction in the alkalinity of the oceans so that they become closer to a neutral state. It sounds very technical, but what it essentially means is that shelly organisms such as clams and prawns and corals can no longer lay down their shells at a rate sufficient to offset the amount at which they're eroded away. So it's always a battle. You lay down extra calcite and aragonite onto your shells to grow them, and they're worn away by abrasion and chemical dissolution in the oceans and so forth. We're rapidly approaching the point at which many of these organisms will no longer be able to put down shells. And at that point, it can have a dramatic effect on the biodiversity of the oceans, and also an impact potentially on the plankton of the oceans, which are these floating plants that also draw in huge amounts of carbon. So a concern is that as we acidify the oceans, we kill off most of the shelly organisms, or at least greatly reduce their diversity and abundance, and we reduce the ability of the oceans to suck carbon out of the atmosphere like it's doing right now. About half of all of the human-caused carbon emissions are going into the oceans right now. If that should reverse due to acidification and warming, then that's going to go back out into the atmosphere, and that's another tipping point that can make the situation worse. So yes, there are reasons beyond CO2 as a warming effect. I talked about the polluting effects of burning fossil fuels, the mercury pollution, the sulfates, the radioisotopes, and of course the direct effect of ocean acidification. Multiple reasons to get off our addiction to fossil fuels.
Thanks, John. Just a couple more questions for you, Barry. Professor Plimer stated on Late Line this week that he felt the emissions trading scheme could kill mining, and that to fully integrate the trading scheme would destroy Australia's greatest wealth-generating industry. He claimed that making futile and expensive attempts to prevent climate change would leave ourselves open to lose all our markets. What do you think of the direction of the Australian government is heading in with relation to carbon trading?
I think Ian Plimer and many other people have a strong point that carbon trading, essentially swapping carbon around in the economy, is a very poor way of putting a price on carbon. In an idealised world, in a utopia where everything worked perfectly, it could end up being the best system for reducing carbon emission. But in the real world, it's so prone to misallocation and grandfathering and subsidising, as is the case with the model proposed by the federal government in their white paper, that it turns out to be near to useless and can be damaging to the Australian economy as a result. So many people, including myself, have argued strongly that you need a price on carbon, so you need to reflect the environmental cost paid by carbon emissions or simply from the pollutants caused by coal-fired power stations. But that doesn't necessarily need to come through a direct cap on carbon. It can come through a tax on carbon, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there are some proposals that the entirety of that tax would be returned back to the Australian people if it was applied in Australia. And that when you were trading with international partners who didn't have a carbon agreement, it would be very much like tariffs at the trade gate, where products that are being exported overseas would have that price removed and those coming in would have that price applied, and so that there would be no net effect on the Australian economy. So I think a price on carbon is ultimately inevitable. I think eventually all nations will be participating in this, but the argument right now, which I think is quite a robust one, is that the scheme that's being proposed by the government within Australia alone will have very little effect and could be quite damaging to the to what we're ultimately after, which is changing over our energy sources.
Okay. Professor Plimer has been very critical of ministers, as he sees it, pushing their own political agendas through the climate change debate. Plimer has stated that governments and the UN are political organisations seeking fame and fortune, and that if you get on the environmental bandwagon, then you could get yourself funded and have a great party, frightening people witless. Do you think it's ironic that Plimer has National Senators Ron Boswell and Barnaby Joyce launching his book around the country this week? Surely this personal and political agendas are overlapping here.
Yes, I think that's very much the case, that you can never divorce these policy-relevant issues from politics. And the fact that one of the parties who happens to be in power right now is proposing an emissions trading scheme almost means by default that the other party will oppose it in some way, and so it ultimately becomes political like that. There are issues of ideology and so forth, but ultimately this should be a bipartisan issue. I mean, it's an impact that will be felt economy-wide, and societal impacts will be across all sectors of our society. And so it's silly to try and break this up as some political game. Ultimately, if we're going to have global agreements and technology sharing agreements and the ability to reduce carbon emissions worldwide, then whether the Labor government or Liberal opposition in Australia support it is essentially irrelevant if this becomes a global issue. There are so many different parties of different orientations in power around the world that it has to be a consensus agreement that this is a right and proper and useful and appropriate thing to do globally. So the political games that are being played right now are being done on a short-term arena for point scoring, and I think that's quite silly, and a lot of people can see it as silly as it is.
What about on political ideologies on a bit broader scale, when you get sort of the left wing tends to argue that there's not going to be any solution in a capitalist model? And that's sort of divided very much on the left and right. But do you have an opinion on that sort of thing? Is there a free market solution to this, or do you where do you stand on that?
I think ultimately the solution can't lie completely in the free market. It has to be regulated, and some aspects of the solution have to be heavily regulated, and other ones can be left quite open to the market. Some of the problems I've encountered myself is, I'm, for instance, a very strong supporter of nuclear power And I think for technical reasons alone, nuclear power is likely to be the way out of this problem, certainly globally, potentially also in Australia. But many people on the left side of politics have had a history of environmental activism against nuclear weapons, for instance, which they connect with nuclear power, and are strongly opposed to that. Whereas, ironically, people on the right side of politics, who tend to be the majority of climate change sceptics, would mostly be supportive of nuclear power. It's ultimately an issue about sensible choices about energy. And my view is on energy that you have to consider all of the options that are available that allow us to avoid these problems. So that's nuclear power, it's wind power and solar power and energy efficiency, the whole lot. And any group that argues that particular aspects of that should be excluded on other grounds, apart from climate change, would have to argue that those grounds are more powerful than those of avoiding climatic catastrophe, which is ultimately what will result if we continue on for another 100 years of business as usual. So you get these strange divisions among the left and the right, and amongst who you would normally consider an environmentalist. For instance, my major area of research is in studying Earth systems, including the ecology of Earth systems. So I've often been labelled a greenie as a result. Right. And so people are quite surprised, well, why do you support nuclear power then? You're a greenie. And I say, well, I'm actually a pragmatist about energy, and I consider this to be the most sensible energy solution. So if you can break this communication issue, I think, which tries to divide it up into to left and right, into Labour and Liberal, if you can actually look at it on a rational basis of what the damage is, who's going to be affected by it, and what the solutions are, then you can break down a lot of those barriers.